What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham.
Mark Latham joins me each and every Thursday afternoon, and he's on the phone now. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Brent. Always good to have a chat.
Likewise. I see that Spy Chief Mike Burgess has warned that Sunni Islamic violent extremism poses the greatest religiously motivated threat in Australia, and has revealed that previously classified details of a foreign interference operation that recruited a former politician who tried to link the spies with a family member of a prime minister. Look, there's been all sorts of things written and said about this already today. I know that Peter Dutton has made comments on radio this morning, and that Richard Marles feels that the name shouldn't be released. Your thoughts, Mark?
Well, I think the former Treasurer Joe Hockey's right in saying if they don't release the name, then it sort of puts a bit of a cloud, a shadow, a slur against a lot of former politicians out of Canberra. So if you're going to make these statements about a very serious matter of a former politician, I assume serving at the time, recruited by, it sounds like, China, and then tried to spread that influence to the Prime Minister's family at the time, it's very serious stuff. And you should back it up by saying, who's the traitor, if you like? Who's the treacherous one? And Joe Hockey's right in saying the person should be named, and everyone else who's not involved obviously has their name cleared, effectively. So it does leave a slur hanging. But is it old news? One of the suggestions around, it's not going to be anything new when I say this, that Senator Sam Dastyari from the Labor Party was kicked out of the Senate because of his association with Wong Jong Mo, an incident where he told that Chinese guy identified as a Chinese spy that they needed to speak on the lawn of the house in Mossman because ASIO could be listening. Yes. So Sam Dastyari got into terrible trouble over this. So maybe what the head of ASIO is talking about is very old news indeed.
Who makes the decision whether the name is published or not? ASIO?
ASIO, I'd say, yeah. ASIO, maybe they consult the Prime Minister about it. The Labor Party sounds like, you know, it might be one of theirs involved. And the Liberal Party is, more bolshy in getting the name revealed, you'd say. But it's a very bad thing overall, whoever it is. It's a terrible thing for Australia that this allegation has been made, and probably also the person has the right to defend themselves if there's anything to defend.
In the outer southeastern suburbs of Melbourne, voters in the seat of Dunkley will go to the polls on Saturday for this crucial by-election. And now this is going to test the Coalition's electoral strategy and offer Labor a chance to turn its recent fortunes around. I suppose in most by-elections there's always a swing against the sitting party. What's your thoughts that will happen on Saturday, Mark?
Well, it's a pretty good test of real-life voting as opposed to opinion polls, which are over the phone and have a margin of error. There's no margin of error on Saturday. Dunkley is held by the Labor Party by 6.3%, which is about the margin, a little bit over the margin of the average by-election swing against governments in Australia. But offsetting that, there'd be a fair bit of sympathy in the electorate for the fact that the by-election's been caused by the tragic death to breast cancer of the former member Peter Murphy. So you'd expect Labor to hold the seat because of that sympathy vote, but there's a poll out showing that the Coalition, the Liberal Party, is narrowly ahead, and if that's the case, I suppose it tells us that Albanese's a bit on the nose. The disastrous voice referendum and the broken promise on tax and other issues, failure to deliver the power price cuts that we were promised, it would be a pretty good win for the Liberals if they can just squeak home.
It seems, from what I'm reading, they really haven't... I make this comment, you may or may not know, you would have an opinion. It seems as though they've kept the Prime Minister away from Dunkley. Is that right or wrong?
Oh, I haven't been down there. It's an interesting seat in eastern Melbourne, outer eastern Melbourne, heading towards the Mornington peninsula. It's got some wealthy, some poor areas, some middle class. You know, it's one of those bellwether seats. Used to be held by the Liberals under the Howard government. I think even the Abbott government, a guy called Bruce Bilson, had it. Maybe demographic change has switched it over to Labor, and Victoria's become more of a Labor state. I think Albanese's done some campaigning there, probably as much as Peter Dutton.
Right.
But on the ground, campaigning in a by-election doesn't count as much as those big national issues they're looking at. I think the Liberals have campaigned really hard on this new so-called car emission tax that the government is levying. There must be a lot of tradies down there in Dunkley, and the Liberals are hoping that that issue grabs. So, yeah, it's going to be a fascinating result on Saturday. It'll end a lot of speculation as to how Albanese is travelling. If he hangs on, the government will take a lot of comfort out of that. If the Liberals win, then Peter Dutton could well think he's on his way to the lodge.
Okay, I see that the Prime Minister won't actually be in Dunkley on Saturday night. He'll be marching in the Mardi Gras, as he's done for quite a few years now.
Yeah, that's something that he's done because of his inner city Graindler electorate with a large gay population. So Albanese's always been a supporter of the Mardi Gras. That's nothing new. The new development is that the New South Wales police won't be there in uniform, which I think is plain wrong. I think when the Mardi Gras made the decision because of the notorious murder of that gay couple in Sydney, that the police weren't allowed to march, the police should have said, oh, well, if that's your decision, then we're not marching then. I think it's unfortunate the police would march in plain clothes because it makes it sound like they're ashamed of their uniform.
Mm.
I think if the police are out there publicly, they should be in uniform. That's part of their public status, their role. And to give the appearance that you're ashamed to wear the uniform is just plain wrong. I think it's uniform or bust. If the police aren't there in uniform, we'll give the whole thing away.
Well, as a couple of callers have said today and a few emails this afternoon, if the police turn up and march in their uniforms, who's going to arrest them?
Well, I suppose that's a comical point, but they'd probably get booed. That's an unfortunate aspect of this. The alleged murderer, a gay man, by the sound of it, he's not representative of the entire New South Wales police force, and it's ridiculous to make that suggestion. I think it was ridiculous to say the police couldn't march, they have in the past. But for most police officers in New South Wales not marching, they'd probably think, well, we've got more important policing work to do anyway.
Speaking of police, it seems as though the Police Commissioner Karen Webb is a major perception problem. Time and again, she has been caught on the defensive in the last week when she should have been on the front foot. There are people calling for her head. What are your thoughts, Mark?
Well, she was an interesting selection by Dominic Perrottet as Premier when he first got in. He was criticised for not having enough women in his cabinet, so he said, oh, well, we'll have a female police commissioner. I think Karen Webb is efficient and capable enough, but I think she's a naturally shy person who just doesn't like the media scrum, doesn't like the all-in media press conferences, and has been reluctant to have them, even if there's a really big thing in the news. Well, it's part of the job. That news on Friday of the police officer charged with the double murder, she had to get out there on Saturday morning and front the media, answer all the questions, give an explanation about the review they're conducting into how he had a weapon, a police-owned weapon. You know, you've just got to do that. It's part of the job. And to not front the media over the weekend, well, there's nothing worse than the media scorn. So they hop into her left, right and centre. And I think it is a valid criticism. Part of the job is to hold public confidence, the confidence of the police officers, that the commissioner can get out there and explain what's going on. It's a basic part of the function, isn't it? So that is a weakness of hers, and she needs to overcome it pronto, I'd say, because there's plenty of critics.
There sure is, yeah, piling on. And what did she say? She said, the police commissioner said on Monday that she declared the criticisms of her leadership were, in her words, offensive.
Well, she might see it that way, but I think if you have that high-profile, highly paid job and there's a major incident of policing or about a single police officer, as there was in this case, it's your job to get out there in front the media and give an explanation of what's going on. I mean, the police have an advantage in media relations, and that is they have background information in all these matters, and the public wants to hear that. The media representatives want to hear that. So it shouldn't be too hard just to give a straight factual explanation of what's gone on. But she seems to get into, that shyness, that personal shyness about the media. She doesn't front. And then when she does, under pressure, there's some mistakes made, like expressing gratitude about the alleged murderer in this case, that he told them where the bodies are. Well, I don't think there's anything to be grateful about the fellow, is there? Since you had to withdraw and apologise for that. So you just make it worse for yourself if you're hiding from the media in that role. The pressure comes on and she makes mistakes. And, yeah, it's a bad look. And I'm sure the police minister and Premier Minns aren't too happy about what's going on, or rather what's not going on.
Former Prime Minister John Howard has said history would treat kindly Scott Morrison's leadership. Mr Howard said that Scott Morrison's thoughtful valedictory speech in Parliament on Tuesday encapsulated who he was. John Howard praised his leadership on AUKUS and handling of the COVID pandemic. He said Scott over time will be seen in a favourable light. Do you agree with John Howard?
Well, I've got to say, prior to the last federal election, I would have thought Morrison was sort of a 6 out of 10 Prime Minister.
Right.
And didn't deserve a lot of the criticism he received. But, geez, the public really, Brent, they just hated the sight of the guy in the end. Maybe he was too often on TV, the daggy dad imagery and PR exercise had worn thin. You know, he had the bushfire problem, some missteps during COVID. And people turned on him. You know, it was almost like people were going to sort of throw their TV through the window if they saw Scott Morrison one more time. So they got rid of him. And I don't think that public mood will change anytime soon. I think his major issue during COVID was to empower the states through the national cabinet, because in the end, the Commonwealth didn't act on its own quarantine power and its own health funding power to run the pandemic response. They gave a lot of power to the premiers. They got out there announcing the numbers every day, and right around the Commonwealth, they became incredibly popular. While anything that went wrong, particularly with the vaccine, Scott Morrison got the blame. So I think that was a political misstep to elevate those premiers to a status we hadn't seen since the time of the Great Depression, really. And I think that's the main problem he had in handling COVID. It should have been a Commonwealth response overwhelmingly. But Morrison's in denial about that. Along with a Liberal MP, we had a bit of a conversation with him in London at a conference, and he won't hear of any criticism of his handling of COVID. But obviously some things went wrong. It was an unexpected crisis, an emergency. I thought he was 6 out of 10, but the general public mood was to give him 3 out of 10 and toss him out.
Have you seen the meme going around that as a result of Tuesday and his stepping away from Parliament, I think it basically says, and I paraphrase here, Coalition loses 6 shadow ministers in one day.
That's very funny. Well, that's the other weird thing. I mean, how do you swear yourself in as Treasurer? He's got Josh Frydenberg lodging at the lodge, and not tell Frydenberg that he's sworn himself into his job. So that was weird, weird stuff. I'm not sure there's any explanation for that, but at the end of the day, it was a minor thing, really, in the sweep of everything that happened during the COVID period. I think one thing for the Southern Sydney electorate of Cook, they'll get now an active member who's doing things, because I think the truth is ScoMo clocked out of Cook a fair while ago. They don't see him down there. So I think the by-election will at least give those local people a busier representative on the local scene.
We're talking to Mark Latham this afternoon. Mark, the latest electricity price hike. My goodness me, there was a story around this week talking about exactly how much the electricity giants, for example, AGL and Origin, each made around $1 billion profit from the price increases they charged you and I, and it seems to be getting worse. And it suggested that maybe this is as a result of the Matt Keane renewables roadmap. Remember him? Matt Keane, who's green?
I remember him very well, and I argued against his roadmap on the basis that every year they'll always levy an amount on the electricity companies that's passed straight on to the consumer. And for the financial year starting on the 1st of July, there's an $81 annual increase in the electricity bill because of the $340 million that's levied to pay for the rollout of these renewables. And this is the whole point. The renewables were always going to cost more, and consumers were always going to pay more because you're building an entirely new electricity grid. Instead of having it based along the East Coast with coal-fired power stations. It's mostly stationed in the western parts of New South Wales with the solar and wind farms that need to be hooked up in so-called renewable energy zones with new transmission wires that are very expensive. So consumers are paying for it. It's true that in the middle of a hot day when there's no clouds, the solar power is quite cheap, but when you add on these extra costs passed on to consumers to pay for the renewable energy zones, and you add on the extra cost as taxpayers for the backup power, pumped hydro. Look at the Snowy 2.0 debacle, costing over $20 billion for a white elephant. We're all paying for it. We either pay as consumers or taxpayers, and there's no way in the world these renewables are cheaper. And, of course, people know that. Once we started on the renewables, the bills went through the roof.
What's happening in the Illawarra with this renewable energy zone? Apparently, no projects have been submitted.
Well, this is the point. Renewable energy zones have sort of been touted as every part of New South Wales can have one. And as fossil fuel jobs are lost, the promise is you can get a new job somewhere in the renewable sector. Well, it's not happening for the Illawarra and Wollongong because, as I said, the solar and wind farms are in the western part of New South Wales. There are very few opportunities. Where are you going to put wind towers on the escarpment down there at the Illawarra? It's just ridiculous. And you haven't got the land there for these big solar farms. So the renewables were never going to produce replacement jobs in the Illawarra. It was always a fake promise, again, from Matt Keane when he was the energy minister, supported by the Labor Party and the Greens. And 12 months of a renewable energy zone, not a single project, not a single dollar of investment, not a single job. So these renewable energy zones are causing nothing but trouble in higher bills and failed promises for working class areas that want new jobs.
Malcolm Turnbull, I see this week he's won, or his company anyway, his company has won contracts for pumped hydro in the Hunter area. That was a story in the Newcastle Herald earlier this week, Mark.
Well, it's a bit comical. He's got a contract to examine pumped hydro at two dams there in the Upper Hunter. There's been a lot of examination of pumped hydro in private investment, and none of the projects stack up. None of them have been funded in New South Wales. And pumped hydro is a bit of a myth in the continental Australia. The mainland is the driest and flattest continent on Earth. So not exactly suited to pumped hydro. It goes all right in Tasmania, but not the mainland. And Malcolm Turnbull, well, have a look at his baby, Snowy 2.0, this $20 billion white elephant. And the farcical news we get all the time that it's way over budget, way overdue, and they've got tunnelling machines there that move a couple of centimetres a day trying to get through the slush. So Malcolm Turnbull's credibility for pumped hydro, I'm afraid, is not very strong, and I'll be very surprised indeed if he generates any electricity for these schemes in the Hunter.
Just before I let you go, your thoughts on Craig Kelly joining Pauline Hanson's One Nation?
Well, they're welcome to have him, and he's welcome to have them from my perspective. Craig was a long-time member for the seat of Hughes in southern Sydney and ran at the last election, only got 8% of the vote. He ran in the last New South Wales Upper House election and got less than 4,000 votes statewide. So he hasn't been a proven vote winner. I find that a strange decision, but I'm out of that party, and I've seen strange decisions in the past. So I'm not necessarily surprised, but I don't think it'll work for them.
I read a story, I think it was yesterday, there was when they made the announcement that he'll be working behind and in front and all this sort of thing. And, you know, Liberal, Independent, United Party, now One Nation. So he's trying them all.
Yeah, and that result in Hughes and then the Upper House last year doesn't indicate that the voters have been flocking to him. So, you know, maybe he'll have more success with One Nation. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, this weekend it's the Rugby League starts in Las Vegas. So go the Bunnies, Mark.
Yeah, we love your team and hope they go all right. Been a big build-up, hasn't it?
I think
everyone's probably going to be glad that the games get played and they can come back to Australia. We've heard so much about it now. But it's a great spectacle. It'll be fascinating to see, can they actually, you know, get their hooks into the American sporting market, which is the biggest in the world. It's a bold venture. I'm very sceptical about what success they'll have. But hopefully the two matches on Sunday are rippers to start the season.
You bet. Good to talk to you as always. Thank you for your time. We'll look forward to catching up with you again next Thursday.
Thanks for having me. Cheers, Brent.
Bye-bye. That's Mark Latham.